Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking about a film from Taiwan called Three Times.
And then I suddenly had this fear, like, oh, don't show a close-up of the hands. And sure enough, he cuts to a close-up of the hands. Oh, that's like a Hollywood move. His audience, we don't need that close-up. We can see them holding hands from across the way.
Said someday you'll find all who love are blind. Oh, when your heart's on fire, you must be alive. Smoke gets in your eyes.
结婚。
This is Robert Davis. Today I have two corrections to make. Well, really it's one correction. Let me explain. Last time I said Ryan Gosling was in this great film last year called Half Nelson, and that he's been in a lot of things since then. And when I said that, I was thinking of The Notebook, Fractured, Lars and the Real Girl, which is his most recent one. Well, it turns out The Notebook was actually made before Half Nelson, and I knew that somewhere deep down, but it doesn't count as something that he's been in since then. And so really, he's only been in a couple of movies since Half Nelson, probably not a lot, as I said. So I should have said Ryan Gosling has not been in a lot of things since then. So, you know, one word was missing there. The second correction is not really a correction. On a previous podcast, I said, hey, one of these days, we are going to talk about a recent film from Taiwan called Three Times by the great Ho Xiao-hsien. And someone said, hey, that movie was in theaters a year ago, and it was at festivals a year before that. So that really doesn't qualify as recent. And my answer to that is an anecdote. Not long ago, I went into a video store in San Francisco looking for a particular DVD, and I like this video store a lot, but I couldn't find what I was looking for because they have everything organized into a million different categories. And so I went up to the desk and I said, hey, I'm looking for Scarface, the old one. Do you have that on DVD? And she said, yeah, sure, it's right here. And she went down the aisle and she came back with something with Al Pacino on the cover. And so I left the video store feeling pretty old, actually. Today we're talking about Ho Xiao-hsien's film Three Times, and it's so recent he's only made one movie since then, a movie called The Flight of the Red Balloon, which I have seen, and I'll tell you what I think of it on a future podcast. Today we're talking about Three Times and some films that were made before that, each of which was his most recent film at some time or another. And joining me today, as always, former drummer for Led Zeppelin, now a film critic in Chicago, J. Robert Parks.
Rob, the first couple of podcast conversations we've had, we've tended to agree, I think, pretty strongly on the movies we were talking about. But the movie we're going to talk about today is one in which I think we differ, at least in some ways. And so I think it would help if you could put that in the context of his larger work. In other words, how do you see that film in relationship to other films that he's made?
I think that's a good way to start, because a lot of people have talked about Three Times as sort of a summation of, or a revisiting of types of movies that he's made in the past. So Ho Xiao-hsien is a filmmaker from Taiwan. He's especially known for this kind of austere style of very long takes, and also for these sort of historical looks at Taiwan, but not distant history, but recent history, 20th century Taiwan, and looking at different pivotal phases in Taiwan's history. And I admittedly know very little about that except what I've learned from his movies. But I know that Taiwan as an island just off of mainland China has been disputed through the last 100 years, and who knows, maybe before that. But it was controlled by Japan for a time, and then controlled by mainland China, controlled by nationalists who were driven out of mainland China. So it's sort of in addition to the people who just lived there before that, has sort of been out of the frying pan into the fire several times, and Ho Xiao-hsien's movies have explored that. So he had a movie called The City of Sadness, which I think was when he first came onto the international film scene. That was in the late 80s, I believe. And that was the beginning of a sort of trilogy about different parts of Taiwan's history. The City of Sadness, The Puppet Master, and then Good Men, Good Women, which is one of my all-time favorite movies.
And I completely agree.
That's a great movie.
Yeah.
And I actually want to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But since then, he has sort of focused a little bit more on the present. He made a movie called Millennium Mambo. I'm skipping a few here. There was actually another one about the present called Goodbye South, Goodbye. Mm-hmm. But then Millennium Mambo and Café Lumière was the movie that he made before Three Times. And then the reason that some people say that Three Times is sort of not exactly a return to form, but a summation of things that he's done in the past is because it's broken up into three parts. It's really like three 40-minute shorts. The first one takes place in, I believe, the 50s, in sort of a simple romance. The second one takes place in the early 1900s in a brothel, which recalls a movie of his I haven't mentioned yet called Flowers of Shanghai. And then the last one resembles Millennium Mambo, that it's this sort of darker vision of people who hang out in dance clubs and have maybe destructive lifestyles. So those are the three times of the movie, Three Times.
Mm-hmm. And for me, there is a little bit of my problem with Three Times is that it feels somewhat repetitive. It feels like it's going back over ground that he's already covered. But I know that's not true for you. So how do you see Three Times in the context of that?
Well, that's true. I made a list of my favorite movies last year, and Three Times was in the top three. And I purposely didn't rank the top three, so it could easily be tied for one, you could say, tied for first. And that's true. Well, first of all, I love his movies, so revisiting them isn't a negative thing to me. Mm. They're beautiful. This movie is as beautiful as any that he's, visually beautiful. But something that I love about Ho Shao Shen is that he sets up these fairly rigid rules for each of his movies. Each one sort of has a different set of rules. And this one, as I described it, it's these three stories. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention that it's the same two actors in each story.
Yeah, which is key.
Which is important. So it's almost as if they're sort of reincarnated in these different eras. Mm-hmm. But he always, after setting up these rules, breaks them. So if we could talk for a few minutes about Good Men, Good Women, I think it sort of it explains a lot about the context that I had going into Three Times and why I'm kind of inoculated from certain types of arguments against Three Times, I think. Yeah. We'll see. So Good Men, Good Women, I think that you like that movie too.
Oh,
right?
It's a great movie. It's my favorite of Ho Shao Shen's work.
It may be my favorite also. It's the third part of this, what's considered a loose trilogy, but they're very loosely connected and it stands alone, certainly. But it's a good example of the kinds of things that he does. It's about a woman who's an actress in the present day who's making a movie about a sort of freedom fighter who was an actual person who lived in Taiwan in the 50s and who was first fighting against Japan, who was ruling Taiwan at the time, but then the nationalists and these sort of anti-communist sentiments that were ruling after that. But it's about the actress who's making the movie about them. So we have these sort of two stories going on at the same time. The movie that she's making, we see in black and white.
Right.
Or maybe it's the movie she's going to make. It's not really clear, but those historical scenes that she is going to be reinterpreting as an actress, we see in black and white with her in that role. And then in the present day, we see things that are going on in her life that are fairly complicated. She is not that type of person. She's like any of us. She has relationships, and one of them has fallen apart in the years before this, and we see some flashbacks to that. So there are actually three times that are going on in that movie. There's the distant past that she's reinterpreting. There's the present, and then there's this relationship she had with a gangster a few years before. And we come to find that he died, and that there was a sort of complicated set of circumstances that happened, and that this wasn't a good time in her life. That she was sort of working as a hostess in some sort of a club, and he was a guy who hung out there, and they didn't have a healthy relationship. So, and the reason she's even thinking about this, and the reason we're seeing flashbacks to it, is because someone has stolen her diary, or she lost her diary, and whoever has it is faxing the pages back to her. Mm. So every day she gets a fax of these things she wrote 4 or 5 years ago about this, which was shortly after, I guess, he had died. And so she's sort of forced to live in these multiple times at once, which is, this is very hard to unravel. And like a lot of his movies, I can't unravel them the first time through. But the most fascinating thing to me about that movie is that it doesn't seem to matter. That I mean, it certainly grows richer the more you are able to unravel it, and the more you sort of put it in context of political history.
Right.
But also, that movie really grabs hold of me by the end. I mean, even if I don't completely understand what's happening precisely when and how these things are related, there is a series of maybe three or four sequences at the end that is just one punch after another. Yeah. One is a fight this actress has with her sister on a volleyball court that is looks so real. Mm-hmm. And then a heartfelt reconciliation that plays out wordlessly on a dance floor with these sort of swirling, colorful lights. And then the most interesting part of all is we go back to the historical part. So it's in black and white. We see the woman who she's playing mourning her husband after we've seen them go through all of these trials of being thrown in prison and everything. She's now mourning her husband, and it's in black and white, and as the camera moves in closer and she's tearful and she's going through this ceremony, the picture very gradually turns to color, mm-hmm. which brings everything together. We know that she's crying tears related to her own relationships, and yet she's using them in this movie, which is just stunning and beautiful and really moving.
That's and also you have in those moments at the end, I mean, the political and social aspects, the historical aspects that are dealt with in that film also kind of come into play, not exactly allegorically, but thematically, so that the divisions that have really racked Taiwan over the years, because you have these conflicts between, you know, various people who came to the island at various times and therefore various sort of power structures that have sort of built up in the island over time, those themes sort of richly unfold and then build to this climax as well. So it's both a climax of this personal story, but it's also a climax of a political idea and a social idea. And so for me, Good Men, Good Women, like so many masterpieces, and I really do think it's a masterpiece, works on a variety of levels. And so, like you said, even though you can't necessarily unravel it the first, second, or even third time, its richness is so strong that it just is. It's beautiful, and it's beautiful how Ho interweaves these various strands.
What's this about Hilary?
There are several interesting things about all this, besides it being a good example of what he does. Even Jonathan Rosenbaum's capsule review of this movie, I mentioned Jonathan Rosenbaum because he's a huge Ho Xiao Xian fan, and I credit him with getting me interested in Ho Xiao Xian. His writings in the Chicago Reader were so impassioned for Ho Xiao Xian that it made me really want to check this guy out, and I came to appreciate them, the movies. But even he... in his capsule, interprets this movie as a critique of present generations by comparing them against earlier generations, which are more noble and were fighting for the people, and the current generations look selfish by comparison. I think that's true, but simplified. Mm-hmm. I think that I believe Ho probably does believe that, and we can see it plain as day ourselves, that these people who are struggling in the present are struggling over things that are very selfish. They're about money, or they're about, you know, what I want for my life. But I don't think that he is critiquing them to the point of invalidating what they feel.
Right.
I think that all of that emotional stuff in that movie, at the end of it, those three sequences, and even one that I forgot to mention, which is this long sequence where she picks up the phone at one of these times when the fax machine normally picks up, and she gets a piece of her diary and instead talks to it, talks to no one, as if it's her dead boyfriend. Mm. And it's just, he lets it play out for a very long time. And this actress is superb. But all of the emotional punches in that movie are in the present. Mm. And then he connects them, as I mentioned, through color, so that we, I think, have an entry into the past.
Right.
But it's not at the expense of the present. Right. And so I don't buy that interpretation, as much as I love Rosenbaum's thoughts on these movies. I don't think it works that way.
No, I think that's right. I mean, just because in all of Ho's films, there's a tremendous empathy for his characters, even as he honestly presents them as flawed. And you know, even in films like Millennium Mambo, there's a real sensitivity to what these people are going through, even if we in the audience and Ho himself may disagree with the choices they've made or are making.
Yeah, you mentioned Millennium Mambo. I think that was maybe the first of his movies where people who had been championing Ho Xiaxian started maybe falling off the bandwagon. Even Rosenbaum called it a beautiful but empty movie or something like that. The most beautiful empty movie he'd seen in a long time or something like that. But there again, I disagree. I think a lot of it has to do with, again, it's about... a woman in a bad relationship, or just the people she's hanging out with, we know are no good for her, and why is she with them? And we spend 2/3 of the movie watching it, and it feels stagnant. But by the end, again, I feel like he has found hope, and it's not good men, good women. I'll acknowledge that, but he has repeatedly through this movie shown this woman traveling through tunnels, mm. And by the end of that movie, these tunnels start to have this resonance that is. Of movement towards something new, and there's a time when she's moving through a tunnel and she sort of looks up through the skylight. This is in a car, you know, it's down a highway, and she looks up through the skylight, and it's this glimmer that we start to see her life maybe changing, and she moves toward this different guy who we think may be better for her, but it's a mirage. And the way that Ho reveals that is really interesting. He does more with music in that movie than he had done previously, I think. There's this sort of throbbing techno beat through a lot of it, except in Jack's apartment, which is very soothing. And so it leads us to believe, I think, that this is the guy who will be a rock, but he may not be a punk, but he's the king of the punks, we'd come to find. And it ends with this really beautiful ending in Japan. It's a different place. And these guys are not there, and she's moving on to, I believe, moving on to a different phase in her life, and it just feels so very hopeful. Mm. Even without the punch of good men, good women, I feel like I can't interpret this movie as, wow, these people today are completely empty, mm. and look how terrible their lives are. I just don't think it's quite that simple. Mm. So seeing these, this is where we come, I think, to Three Times, which is. I sort of described the structure, but what's interesting to me about Ho Xiaoxin is that he sets up these really strict rules for how his movies work. Like in Good Men, Good Women, there's the black and white for the historical stuff and color for the present. But once he's set these rules up and followed them very closely, he starts to break them just in little ways. In Good Men, Good Women, there's, of course, the pivotal scene that turns from black and white to color in the middle of it. But before that, he does these playful things. Like, he'll shoot a scene that's so dark that you can't tell if it's in black and white and color until someone turns on the bulb, mm-hmm. and then you know. Or he shoots a scene looking straight up through trees at the sky, and so you can't tell, are we in the present or the past? And mm-hmm. then he pans down, and you realize, okay, we're in the present, I get it. Or he's looking at the top of it's this green expanse, and he pans down and you realize it's the top of the dome of this badminton court. Mm. You know, so these kinds of playful, he knows his rules, and he starts gradually poking at them to see if you're paying attention, I guess, or just because he enjoys this. And Three Times is the same way. We talk about it being three different time periods, but it's not. It's four. The opening sequence is none of those three. It looks most like the first segment. because it's the couple in a pool hall. But the pool table is not the same pool table. It's one of those weird pool tables with no pockets, and it only has red balls. And also, their relationship seems different. They obviously know each other. She's rooting for him. She's invested in this game that he's playing, even though she's not playing. Where in the actual first time of the three times, they haven't really met. They don't know each other, and so it's all new. And the pool table is different. Why? I'm not exactly sure, but I love those kinds of things. Mm. Also, the second of the three times, the one that takes place in the early 1900s in a brothel, people compare it to Flowers of Shanghai, which takes place in a really similar setting. But the second segment of Three Times is a silent film, which is drastically different from Flowers of Shanghai or any movie that's being made. You know, a silent movie is very different, works in very different ways. But even that is deceptive because there is a sound sequence in the second time. It isn't entirely silent. There's a key moment when a young girl is being taught to play an instrument that we see the other women who work in this brothel play. And I think it's really interesting that we hear that and we hear the instructor teaching this to her. And it's almost eerie that suddenly this world that sort of looks quaint and beautiful and yet is a little bit dark because these women are not exactly slaves, but they're certainly economically bound to this world.
Right.
Which is important in Flowers of Shanghai too. It's almost like a portrait of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see it in its infancy. Here we see someone being indoctrinated in some ways. You know, in a previous podcast, we were talking about Abbas Kiarostami's homework, about how these kids have these sort of rote things that they learn. We just saw this yesterday at the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley. Well, here we see this young girl who's being trained in this world, and you can't help but think, wow, what else could this girl be doing besides training for a brothel? I mean, that's and to make that the realistic moment in the second time is really fascinating. Mm. And then the third time, I'm not sure that he breaks the rules in the third time, but I think in some of the summaries that I hear of Three Times, it's sort of described as the ugly one because if the first one is very sentimental and romantic, and the second one is somehow quaint and beautiful and maybe a little disturbing, the third one is like the opening parts of Millennium Mambo, dark, and it's about destructive behavior and suicide.
And it's in present day.
And it's in present day, right. And yet it's beautiful. It's colorful. It's in fact, on my blog, when I made my list of my favorite movies of last year, and I had Three Times at the top, the still that I chose was from that segment because I think it really is beautifully shot. There is this hallway that figures prominently in the whole thing, where there's this kind of fluorescent light that the characters are able to pick up and hold up to their faces or hold up to the pictures that are on the wall, and it just makes these really neat. Really neat shadows, and I just find it interesting that he can find beauty in this thing that is ostensibly ugly,
which has always been a hallmark of his. I mean, I can think of hardly any other filmmaker who does such beautiful things with light, particularly natural light. Whenever I think of Hoshō Shen, I always think of the opening sequence in Café Lumière, where the light is sort of streaming through these dresses that are hanging out and these shirts that are hanging out on the line outside this window. And so we're seeing this filtered light. And that's just, he's spectacular. And we see that in the first sequence of Three Times as well, in this kind of around this pool hall, the way he uses light coming in through a doorway, or when the young man and the young woman are standing outside, and the way the light sort of shines across them, and often it's, you know, magic hour lighting or twilight light, and it's just spectacularly beautiful. You'll get no argument with me there.
It's Mark Lee Pingbing is usually the cinematographer that he's working with. He's really great. He's worked with Wong Kar Wai, I believe, too, and other good filmmakers.
It's brilliant. But for me, and I completely agree with pretty much everything you've said, but there's still a frustration for me with actually each of the three times, in that, and you mentioned that the first time is romantic and sentimental, and it absolutely is, which I don't have a problem with, But it strikes me as overly sentimental. Someone in Toronto where we saw the film described it as sort of a pastiche of Wong Kar-wai. and it feels like that to me. My favorite example, the thing that sort of encapsulates my frustration with the film, is towards the end of the first sequence, or the first time. The two characters have finally come together. There's this sort of, you might call it a dance, in which they're pursuing each other and not being pursued. And then at the end, they've come together. And there's a beautiful long shot, long take, where we see them hold hands. And it's very lovely. And I remember in the movie theater thinking, oh, that's really great. And then I suddenly had this fear, like, oh, don't show a close-up of the hands. And sure enough, he cuts to a close-up of the hands. And it was so infuriating to me. It was like, oh, that's like a Hollywood move. It's not Hosho Shen. You know, his audience, we don't need that close-up. We can see them holding hands from across the way. and yet to cut to the close-up struck me as overly sentimental. I mean, do you agree, or did you actually like that cut?
Well, but you know, he's playing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Rain and Tears.
Oh, I know. It's so Wong Kar-wai-like. It's like it's...
Well, but I think back to Millennium Mambo, where the music was so seductive, where we were lulled into thinking that Jack was this perfect guy and then found that we weren't. I remember the moment where we sort of realized, I think there are hints before, but the moment where you know for sure is where she has come back to his apartment not feeling well. She collapses on the couch and she leaves his front door ajar. Later he comes and he sees his door ajar, and what's his first reaction is to pull the gun out of his pocket and snoop around his apartment looking for who might be in his be in there. Well, that's a pretty telling reaction. Anyway, the point is that I think we begin to realize that Ho was being trickier maybe than we might have thought. And so that makes me think about Three Times. Well, yeah, I agree with you. It's this neat little romantic movie, if you want to see it that way. But then I have to ask, well, why tell that story as a part of these three? Why then move to 1911 and tell this other story? What's the connection here? Why tell these together in one?
And why do you think?
Well,
and,
I don't.
And let me also. Why do you think to go not in chronological order?
Well, yeah, that's another interesting question. So that it's not like we're seeing these people recur, and we're seeing a pattern of now what are they going to do? You know, it really is three detached times. But then why tell them together?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. But a part of me wants to pursue this this seductiveness when it seems so obvious to everyone who's seen the movie that the first one is overly sentimental and the last one is overly cold. I have to wonder is that true? Maybe that's true. But then maybe that's not so true. Maybe it's that. Our understanding of relationships is sometimes simplistic and idealized in exactly the way that happens in the first one. But if you look a little further, it's not as if he's idealizing the past and saying the present is where we're messed up, because he goes back further in the past in the second one, which is clearly darker than the first one,
right,
and has these undertones where it isn't just about love. It's about economics
and control
and coercion,
yep,
and entrapment. And so then what does that say about the third one? It may say that, well, things have always been... First of all, I can't sum up the movie in pithy statements, but maybe love is just not as simple as we thought and as we sometimes idealize. And yet it's still recognizable. And in the third one, I think we see things pulling on these relationships, and we see where they're flawed. But they are still relationships, and they are still there, and people do still care.
Yeah.
My other thought about this is that not every juxtaposition is a moral stance. I think it's very hard to sort of see things put side by side and not assume he's saying, well, this good, that bad. But I don't think he's necessarily doing that.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
It's for me, again, it's not that I dislike Three Times. I find it frustrating And I agree that I think there is a really, by juxtaposing the three, he sort of, because there's a lot of commonality there too, right? I mean, as sentimental as the first time is, as you mentioned, cold as the third one is, and the second one also strikes me as a bit cold. We do sort of have an idea of the difficulties of love, and how hard it is to come together. And yet, I found that theme to be much richer in Ho's earlier films. Flowers of Shanghai, I think, is just a stunningly great portrait of love's bonds and everything that bonds implies. Whereas reducing it to a 40-minute sequence in the second time, it doesn't have the richness for me that the whole movie does in Flowers of Shanghai. And so therefore I find it frustrating that he's revisiting these themes that to me he's visited before in much greater depth. Mm-hmm. But you would disagree, I assume.
Well, I don't think I know yet where this fits into his body of work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't immediately grab me the way Good Men, Good Women did, or even Flowers of Shanghai.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel to me like a retread, okay. Even though much of it is familiar. Even some things in the first one, the couple, they keep sort of passing each other on these boats that go by each other and they don't notice it. They're going opposite directions on boats. It is very much like something that happened in the previous movie, Café Lumière, but it's subway trains that are sort of crossing in different directions. But the reason I think it's interesting to do that is because it's almost like self-examination to circle back and look at not just what you did previously, but to take two or three things that you've done previously and put them side by side and see what comes out of that. That's what cinema is juxtaposition of shots, of sequences, of items. Mm-hmm. And what if you did that on sort of a larger scale? I think Flowers of Shanghai does have some similarities to the second time and three times. But I don't think that this is just a recreation of it in 40 minutes. I think it has a lot of formal differences. First, that it's a silent movie.
Well, what impact do you think the fact that it is a silent movie has?
Well, it allows that one sequence to become vividly different, mm-hmm. The sequence with the young girl. I think it's also just sort of an interesting formal experiment that it is a silent movie in that nobody's talking and there are intertitles and there's music that it changes keys when the scene changes, like silent scores often do. And yet it isn't shot like a silent movie. Mm. It's color. It uses his same long take style. Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily look like a silent movie, but he's borrowed a lot of silent movie techniques. But it also has maybe interesting resonance with the third time in that communication issues arise in the third one. I think in the first one, we see them crossing in boats that are going opposite directions, and it's cute. In the second one, it's completely silent, and so we're suddenly distanced from communication. And then in the third one, they send instant messages and emails to each other, and communication is distant in these characters' lives, and it isn't necessarily cute anymore. You know, there are sort of dark messages there. They're crossing in the night in a lot of ways, but we're not smiling and laughing about it like people do in the first one, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, and I can see that. I guess my problem with the film is that a lot of the formal experimentation feels a lot like experimentation to me, but not necessarily. I can't figure out to what end. And there's lots of films in which I'm more than happy to be baffled. But it struck me that three times is a... I wasn't sure that Ho actually knew where it was going. In other words, why go out of chronological order? Why do this in silence? And I agree that it makes the one sequence very effective, but I'm not sure it's worth it for the whole 40 minutes. Again, I wouldn't want to be presumptuous, and it's not like I dislike the film. But I find it a frustrating film, mm-hmm. And I find it frustrating because he's such a filmmaker I admire so much, and yet I wasn't I just wasn't taken with it, like you and so many other people were.
I think that may be right, that Ho isn't entirely sure how these three things fit together. It may be more of a research project than an experiment in the true sense of the word, that we'll put these together and see what happens. Let's see what resonance mm-hmm. comes out of them. Maybe there won't be any.
Right.
Maybe there is some. But it at least it doesn't feel like stagnation to me. It feels mm-hmm. like, let's try this and see what happens. Maybe it isn't perfectly harmonious, but I'm not sure. You know, mm-hmm. it's something that just popped into my head is I just recently revisited the Jim Jarmusch film Night on Earth, which is five different cab rides in five different cities.
That's right.
And it's sort of widely considered to be not one of his strongest films, and it's sort of the end of his early period when he made these movies about these characters from different cultures who sort of got into the same cab in this case, where, you know, they just were thrown together and down by law, they're all in a jail cell. It's John Lurie, Roberto Benigni, and Tom Waits, so it was very funny. And it sort of felt like coasting, I think, to a lot of people, Night on Earth did. Well, he's just doing this again. But that was before anyone knew he was going to make Dead Man and Ghost Dog.
Right.
And what's most interesting to me about those movies is they're great. Mm-hmm. They're deeply profound mm-hmm. and questioning and curious about the world and wondering about what we are like as people. And yet he did not abandon this early episodic style and dry humor. He managed to move it to a new level by sticking with things that were interesting to him and finding new ways to use that in a much more artistic way.
Mm.
And so it's hard for me now to go back and look at Night on Earth and not think, well, you know, it's not a masterpiece, but I like to see all those elements in there. And I wonder how we'll look back on, obviously Ho Chi Minh is a far more sophisticated filmmaker at this stage than Jarmusch was when he made Night on Earth.
Sure,
I think
he's made a lot more movies.
Yeah,
else.
But still, I think it might. I still think it's interesting when artists are circling back, mm-hmm. not making lateral moves or regressing, but are considering what they've done and wondering what else they might be able to find in it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I wouldn't want to sort of make a final judgment on three times in any way. But I love your example of Jim Jarmusch because that film was actually the first Jarmusch film I saw. And so for me, I came to it fresh and I loved it because I hadn't seen Down by Law, because I hadn't seen, you know, Stranger Than Paradise. And it's worth saying that you and I come to three times with a sort of a long background in Ho's work. But for people for whom this is their first Ho film, this might be a great introduction. It might be the sort of thing in which it would, you know, you might get a glimpse of what makes him so great. And of course, you wouldn't have the background, but that might actually in certain ways be a good thing because you wouldn't necessarily be drawing comparisons to Flowers of Shanghai or to Millennium Mambo or to other stuff that he's done.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible that you see the first segment and think it's just the most charming thing in the world.
Yeah, until the cuts to the close-up of the hands. Any last thoughts, Rob?
I think one thing I'll mention is that where a lot of people, I think, came to Millennium Mambo and felt like they were starting to lose interest in Ho Chi Minh, or maybe felt like it was a lesser movie. I didn't have that experience, but I had that experience later with Café Lumière.
Oh, funny. I had the experience that other people have.
I felt like Café Lumière was really slight
mm-hmm.
and even awkward in a couple of places mm-hmm. And so thin that I didn't have a lot to grab onto. And for the first time, I walked out of a Ho Chi Minh movie disappointed. I often walk out a little bit perplexed or not entirely sure of how it all works, but not disappointed like I did that time. Well, I saw it again. Both times were on the big screen, and it was really good. Mm-hmm. And I think that it helped knowing the scope of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not every movie is a big, meaty, complex thing. Sometimes a movie is a little gem, and I think Café Lumière is a little gem.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that going in and just soaking it up, I really appreciated it. And so it's hard for me to even know how three times will age
mm-hmm.
For me whether I'll still like it as much as I do now. But I know at this point that it's still fascinating to me. So we'll see.
I think this idea of expectations is one that you and I will revisit a great deal, because I believe it's a really huge factor that often film critics overlook in how we come to film. I had the experience that a lot of people have with Millennium Mambo, which is that I found it a bit disappointing. Not, again, a bad film, but a disappointing film, particularly after the, you know, sort of how towering Flowers of Shanghai is. And so therefore, I came to Café Lumière with somewhat lower expectations, and I loved it. I agree with you, it's slight. It's even awkward in places, but I love lots of things about it. And so I think then I came to Three Times again with quite a bit higher expectations, and maybe those weren't quite fair. And so it's hard to, and I need to revisit it too.
Well, I imagine we're both looking forward to seeing his next movie. I know
that's
I am.
A fact.
It's it stars Juliette Binoche, which is a very interesting pairing. It's the first time he's, I believe it's the first time he's gone to a European actor for a movie that's, I believe, in French even. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I'm certainly going to be there whenever it's showing.
Yeah, that'll be exciting. Thank you, Rob.
All right. Well, thanks for your thoughts. Well, I'm not sure I connected all of the dots in my argument, but these are some good films, and you should check them out sometime. You can find more episodes in this series of podcasts at erratamag.com. That's erratamag.com. And there you can also leave us a comment if you have feedback, or send email to feedback@erratamag.com, or call 415-287-4020 and leave us a digital voicemail. We'll be back next time to talk about the latest film from the Coen brothers, No Country for Old Men, starring Tommy Lee Jones, Javier Bardem, and Josh Brolin, and the new film from Wes Anderson, The Darjeeling Limited, starring Owen Wilson, Adrian Brody, and Jason Schwartzman. It's next time.